This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. 100 years ago, intrepid gentlemen in the fastest cars of the day were invited to start their engines, and the Indianapolis 500 was underway. The race, established by an entrepreneur named Carl Fisher, has accumulated various traditions over the years. One of them, which began in 1921, can be characterized as poetic. So it was that on May 30th, 1927, for 25 cents, racing fans could purchase an official program which contained, among other elements, a peppy rhymed celebration of the very event they'd come to witness. The poet responsible for the poem titled The Click of the Turnstiles was William Herschel, an Indiana newspaper man.
The Speedway Turnstile sang today, a jovial jazz time rondelay. Each clickety-click was friendly, gay in fact. Somehow, they seemed to say, oh, here come the Weavers, the Beavers, McKeevers. They've lizzied in from Kankakee. The Saxtons, the Paxtons, the Christopher Claxtons from Kennebunk by the sea.
By 1927, William Herschel had been writing verse for the race program for several years. It's amusing stuff, but he probably wasn't doing it strictly for his own amusement and that of his readers.
I'm sure Carl Fisher slipped Herschel a few dollars for his contributions.
Jared Carter, an Indiana native, is a celebrated poet who now lives in Indianapolis, and he's familiar with William Herschel.
He did quite well. He was popular. Everybody knew him. And he was part of a clique of local Corn Belt intellectuals, I think you could call them. These are popular poems. These are not artsy poems, and yet he is a skilled writer. There's no question. He employs every poetic device there is, practically, to make them smooth, readable, legible, and lots of fun.
Either because it was popular or because it was deemed excellent promotional material for the auto race it celebrated, William Herschel's poetry appeared in the Indianapolis 500 program until 1928. Then, although Herschel was still writing for the Indianapolis News, his verse unaccountably disappeared from the program, or perhaps not so unaccountably.
Money. The Depression hit. And everybody was hard up, and I'm sure Fisher was too. He had to cut some corners.
The race was devoid of rhyme for decades. The nonprofit Indiana Humanities eventually noticed that shameful circumstance. This weekend's 100th anniversary of the Indy 500 was deemed the appropriate time to bring poetry back to the track. A contest was devised. Over 200 poets submitted their efforts, and
they picked my poem, so I was the lucky winner.
Adam Henze is the official poet of the 2016 Indy 500. His poem is titled For Those Who Love Fast, Loud Things.
This poem is for the track folk who just love the smell of ethanol, for the carb day cut sleeve sporters, the snake pit dancers, and coke lot campers with bald eagle bandanas.
Gone are the Weavers, the Beavers, and the McKeevers. And where are the Saxtons, Paxtons, and Christopher Claxtons? And come to think of it, where are the cars?
I don't really think that my poem was about cars. I think that my poem was about people who love cars. And I'm talking about that Indianapolis type of race fan that's kind of different than NASCAR fans or Formula One fans. I definitely think that they are their own type of breed.
According to Donald Davidson, the official historian of the race, Henze's focus on the people who love the race rather than the drivers or the cars is appropriate to the 100th anniversary of the 500.
People will greet you one after another and say, this is my 47th in a row, and they just tell you how many times they've gone.
Almost everything except the location of the race has changed over the years. The cars are faster, of course. The drivers make a lot more money. And the poetry, yes, according to Jared Carter, the poetry has changed a good deal as well. Though he says the historical roots of the format Adam Henze employs run deep.
His immediate ancestor is Walt Whitman. And so what Henze gives us is a list poem. I'm going to list everything I can think of that's out there that's crazy and fun. Mm-hmm. And he does. He lists all kinds of stuff.
I just hope they love it. I hope that people find themselves in the poem, that they see all of the different types of people who are at the 500 conveyed in my poem.
No doubt many of those attending the Indy 500 will identify with the gearheads and those who love the smell of ethanol, but just because Henze's poetry has eclipsed the jaunty verse of William Herschel, should his efforts be forgotten?
Say, fellows, have pity. We can't name each city, nor recognize every face. We're tickled to see you. We wish we could be you. us turnstiles have not seen a race.
I don't think so. Do you? Before the pitch of every Major League Baseball game, sometimes even before half the crowd has made it to their seats, somebody takes the field and sings the national anthem. We don't often find ourselves thinking about those performers after the brave have found their way home, unless it all goes terribly wrong. Only a Game's Karen Given has our story.
About a month ago, during a Friday night dinner with her family, 89-year-old Hermina Hirsch half overheard a conversation between her two sons. She remembers them saying something about baseball and the national anthem.
Something like that. And I said to them, boys, I am going to sing the national anthem. Not I would like to, but I said I am going to sing.
Hirsch doesn't know much about baseball. She was born in what was then Czechoslovakia, but she knows the U.S. national anthem really well.
I love this song, and I do it frequently for my chapter or the Holocaust survivors when we get together once a week.
Hirsch lost her parents, three brothers, and aunts and uncles at Auschwitz. She moved to Detroit in 1953. But back to that dinner with her family last month.
That was Friday night. Sunday morning, my oldest son showed up with his pocket radio, you know.
I'm pretty sure the word Hirsch is looking for here is smartphone.
And took a picture of me and said, go ahead and sing because I know somebody who wants to hear your voice.
Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light?
The video made a big splash online. Detroit media showed up at Hirsch's door for interviews. They asked her if she would be nervous to sing in front of a crowd. If I lived through the concentration camp, she told them, it couldn't be that bad. Last Saturday night, Hermina Hirsch got her wish.
When I sang at the bar game, I said, my goodness. I had to lift my hand to God that I see so many people and they all cheering for me.
After she sang, Hirsch and her family watched the game together. Then they all went out for pizza to celebrate. Hirsch took home many great memories of singing in Comerica Park, but she didn't take home a paycheck.
No. And I don't even want to be paid because this is an honor that my kids will remember when I am gone. They all came, my children, my grandchildren, and my great-grandchildren. So that was enough pay for me.
And that's how it's supposed to go, right? A happy performer, a happy family. The Tigers even won that game, 5-4. But it doesn't always go that well. In fact, every once in a while, it goes very, very badly.
I'm working on now of actually trying to get some people to come in to help counsel chorus members who have to deal with this.
That's Bob Lehman, executive director of the San Diego Gay Men's Chorus. On the same night as Hermina Hirsch's triumph in Detroit, the Gay Men's Chorus was set to perform in San Diego. Lehman and about 100 members of the chorus had been looking forward to the evening since January, when the Padres invited them to perform at Pride Night. They'd done it once before, last fall, and it had gone really well. This new date meant a lot to some of the chorus members.
I had one young man from North Carolina, and he was using this as an opportunity to help his relationship with his father, and he thought this was something common ground they had, professional baseball, so you know, for him being on the field was, you know, probably the biggest day of his life.
When the chorus performed in the fall, the members who didn't want to buy tickets to the game simply went home when the anthem was over. But this time, someone at the Padres sent an email making clear that wouldn't be acceptable.
And it kind of insinuated that we knew that we had to pay for tickets and that we never should have expected to get in for free and kind of accused us of not sponsoring the event.
It took a little while, but the Padres eventually apologized and conceded that the chorus members who didn't want to stay and watch the game didn't need tickets. Which doesn't mean the team didn't make any money on the arrangement. Bob Lehman spent $360 on tickets for friends and family.
I was hoping we could put that all behind us. We were looking forward to singing that night.
As is customary at Petco Park, the chorus pre-recorded their performance for the evening. The Padres insist on it.
So you would think, oh, well, we're just singing along with, you know, music that everybody's going to hear. You're not nervous. But, you know, it was a huge game. It was the Dodgers and the Padres. So there were, you know, over 40,000 people in the stands. That was going to be our biggest live audience ever in our 31-year history.
So what happened?
Just as we prepared to sing, we were standing in center field, and our artistic director raised his arms to start us. And instead of our music starting, it was the voice of one single woman singing the national anthem.
Can't you see?
You know, it felt like forever. Even then, you know, 90 seconds or so of the song just seemed like a lot longer than normal. We eventually joined in and sang along because that's what you do to the national anthem. As we were leaving the field, there was some applause of encouragement, people saying, keep your heads up, there'll be another time. But then, unfortunately, there were a couple jeers. One person yelled, you sing like a girl.
Lehman says San Diego hasn't always been the most welcoming place for the LGBT community. He says protesters showed up at his wedding. But, he says, last Saturday night's debacle was just a mistake. And as a result of conversations he's had this week with Padres CEO Mike D, the team and San Diego Pride have forged a much better relationship. Lehman says something really positive has come out of all of this. But the San Diego Gay Men's Chorus is not yet ready to commit to a future performance at Petco Park. I wasn't able to find out whether any of baseball's 30 teams pay their performers or provide more than a ticket or two per group free of charge. Major League Baseball would only say that the league had no central policy on the issue. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
Thank you for listening to the Only a Game podcast. Please leave your comments about Only a Game on iTunes and rate us. That way, other podcasters will know we're available. It's like an audio mitzvah, if you will. I'm Bill Littlefield.
So we have to continue to find ways in which to make our game safer. We're not done yet. I put that as a very important concern for us going forward.
NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell made those comments on Tuesday, and we'll explain why on this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know. My guests are David Steele of the Sporting News and Craig Calcaterra of NBC Sports. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
David, why was Roger Goodell on the defensive again this week?
When is he not on the defensive?
Exactly.
It's incredible. They had pledged $30 million to concussion research that was going to be spearheaded by the National Institutes of Health. And a congressional committee released its findings in an investigation. What they found was that the league was taking aim at several of their critics who had come down harshly on the way that the league has handled concussion research. The league had tried to basically push them aside.
In other words, remove them as recipients of this money. We'll give the money to somebody, but not to these doctors who don't like us.
That is exactly what it is, and people who are more favorable to us. And there are a lot of the heavy hitters who are really meddling. I mean, that's really the best word we can use, meddling in what the NIH was doing in terms of concussion research.
Craig, does it seem to you that David is exaggerating in any way the NFL's malfeasance here?
No, that's what it does. I mean, it does this on the PR front. It does this in the legal world. Go ask Tom Brady how that's working out for him. This is something that strikes to the very heart of the league. There are always PR dust-ups. There are always players who can get in trouble, but they could always be cut loose because players in the NFL are fungible. But when you have something that goes to the very pursuit of the sport, large men hitting each other at high rates of speed, that goes to the NFL's very viability. And so I don't think they will do anything or not do anything to try to make that story turn out a little bit better for them.
It's a dangerous sport. Guys bang into each other hard on every play. And even now, allegedly protected by the new rules, 30% of these guys are going to have cognitive problems in retirement. This is the league statistic, not one that I've made up. And the problem is exacerbated by the spectacle of the NFL trying to say which doctors should be studying what. No, they don't get to call those shots.
Yeah, the league is doing an absolutely just reprehensible job of taking responsibility and being fully accountable for the part they play in all of this. And if it doesn't get better, then something a lot worse than a congressional committee is going to be holding their feet to the fire from now on.
Craig, I understand that although Mets pitcher Matt Harvey would just as soon nobody pay attention to him at this point in his career, you have been paying attention. What's going on?
Oh, everyone's been paying attention. And I like that you mentioned the word accountability a second ago, because that's the word that's being used here, although in a much more frivolous fashion than it is with the NFL. Matt Harvey on Tuesday night got shelled once again. He's been having a terrible year. And after the game, he decided not to meet with the assembled members of the sporting press, which, if you follow baseball for a long time, you realize is the cardinal sin, at least in the eyes of the media. It used to be a situation where the press would say, how dare he not answer to us? They realize that's not a very good look. So now it's, how dare he not be accountable to his fellow teammates who now have to answer questions about him when he should be answering them. Never mind that they're still going to ask those questions of his teammates anyway. It's kind of ridiculous. He's not allowed to take 10 minutes and go blow off some steam, or else he's considered the most evil villain in New York sports this week anyway.
David, are you similarly outraged with all those columnists in New York?
As somebody who used to be in the clubhouse with the New York media, there have been times when I've been disgusted with myself with what we're with what we're entitled to do. Because, yeah, I mean, I think that beneath the whole concern about, hey, is he talking or is he not talking? Is he accountable or is he not accountable? That, yeah, he's somebody who's having a real career crisis right now for a lot of reasons. His health, his effectiveness, his money, you know, his injury history. It kind of waters down the meaning of a word like accountability if you apply it to that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have the great luxury of not being a beat writer, and I've never been a beat writer, and so I can adopt the high ground on this. I don't think players should be required to talk to reporters. I don't want to talk to somebody who doesn't want to talk to me in a locker room or anywhere else.
I'm totally with you on that. Players, if they really want to get their message out, are able to do it on any number of platforms. So going in and asking, talk about that pitch in the sixth inning seems a little bit weird to me.
Let's move from baseball to basketball. I've been watching the NBA playoffs along with lots of other people, and I suggest that somebody who intentionally kicks an opponent during a basketball game should be tossed out of that game and suspended for the next one as well. Draymond Green is the guy who did that. He wasn't suspended. Green was fined $25,000, which in the NBA doesn't mean a whole heck of a lot. The average salary is somewhere between $4 and $5 million a year. Lots of writers have congratulated the NBA for its level-headedness. He's an important player, and the argument was it was an important game. And that sort of importance shouldn't be the point. You cannot kick your opponent in the groin or the head or the stomach or anywhere else for that matter and stay on the floor. David, which side are you on?
Kick him out. I was appalled by the reaction by a lot of people. I mean, you know, hey, he kind of forfeited his right to to claim that, hey, this would throw the balance of the series off the moment he decided to swing his foot.
Craig, are we going to make it 3-0, or are you going to take the other side on this one?
I can't even pretend to be contrary, and I do that very well most of the time. So, no, you know what really would have thrown this series? If he would have ruptured something critical on that guy that he kicked. Oh! That would have really thrown the series. The fact that a player is in a game, no matter what, come hell or high water, that's important to the players and the team. Shouldn't be important to the league. They're a regulatory body. They're not a rooting interest. Same with the media. The idea that we're going to all of a sudden have a sliding scale on brutality because something's that much more important seems really ridiculous to me.
My guests for Three Stories You Should Know have been David Steele of the Sporting News and Craig Calcaterra of NBC Sports. Thanks to both of you. This was fun.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks a lot.
Commentator Mike Pesca has been watching the news, as he always does, and he's made an observation.
This week, a famous, perhaps the most famous participant of the most popular sport in America attempted to keep doing the thing that made him among the greatest. He tried against orders, against advice, perhaps against reason, certainly against the odds. Cue the stirring background music. Call the guys at 30 for 30. Who is this? Who is this hero infused with a stalwart's dedication, a role model, who you could say literally is trying to fulfill his patriotic mission? It's Tom Brady, and he's trying to get out of that whole Deflategate thing. You know Deflategate, a.k.a. the case of the mushy footballs. Think about where we are with Deflategate, where we as a nation of sports fans are. Let me read a headline, and let's just pause for a minute to consider the implications of said headline. Brady appeals Deflategate suspension reinstatement. And the thing about this headline is, to the vast majority of Americans, certainly American sports fans, that collection of words makes sense. The syntax has meaning. Appeal Deflategate suspension reinstatement. Maybe if I emphasize every syllable, it will make clear how Byzantine the saga has been. The appeal means he's asking for a rehearing of a reinstatement that was revoked. I believe that to be a conditional quadruple negative. And yet, I would say, I don't know, 60% of NFL fans know exactly what I'm talking about. 96% of New England Patriot fans. Brady supposedly knew that his footballs in the AFC Championship game of 2 years ago were inflated under the proper PSI. Now, the rules of journalism say I need to spell out PSI. But this is my point. We're so familiar with Deflategate. You know what PSI is? It's like I wouldn't spell out FBI or RSVP. That's the familiarity. So Brady was suspended, then not, then suspended, and now he hopes not. The breakup of Ma Bell took less time than the Deflategate punishment. And what's so fascinating is that sports media just has to say anything about Deflategate, and millions of people will know exactly where we are in the story, what the stakes are, and if they're fair-minded folk, i.e. if they agree with me, they will have strong opinions about inflation gauges, Goodell's overstepping his authority, and maybe they can cite a clause or two of the ideal gas law. Now, here are some things Americans know less about than Deflategate. 5 years ago, Newsweek recently asked 1,000 citizens to take America's citizenship test, and 46% were unable to identify the Bill of Rights. The National Constitution Center found 40% of adults know that there are 100 senators in the Congress. Annenberg found that only 38% of Americans know the Republicans control the House of Representatives. I can go on and on. I think more people know about Deflategate than know about the basics of American life. Now, I did come across this one statistic, and I guess it was heartening. It's from that 2011 Newsweek story. They found that 29% of Americans didn't know who the vice president was. And while that might seem disturbing, it means that 71% of your fellow Americans could name the vice president. And you got to believe that fewer than that could tell you something about Deflategate. Though I'm sure that many of the 71% who could name the vice president were prodded with the suggestion, you know, the guy who's like the federal government's version of Tom Brady's backup, Jimmy Garoppolo.
Mike Pesca hosts the daily podcast The Gist from Slate. He's a panelist on the sports podcast Hang Up and Listen, which posts every Monday. Ben Lindbergh and Sam Miller are baseball stats guys. Ben's a staff writer for ESPN's 538. Sam's the editor-in-chief of Baseball Prospectus, and together they host Effectively Wild, the Baseball Prospectus podcast. Last year, through a combination of unlikely circumstances, they were offered the opportunity to put their analytics to work on behalf of an actual baseball team, an independent low minor league team called the Sonoma Stompers. One of their first tasks was to find players at a preseason tryout camp in Sonoma, and according to Sam, the participants had something in common.
Everybody who's at that tryout has something wrong with them, and you're just waiting to find out what that thing wrong is.
Sam and Ben share the story of that day.
By sheer unfortunate coincidence, we were wearing matching rust brown corduroys and black hoodie sweatshirts, so we had our own accidental uniform.
We weren't really introducing ourselves to anyone. We were just sort of people flitting around the background with notepads and pens and stopwatches. We were trying to look coachy.
We knew that the 100 guys that were out there contained about 97 wannabes. And so what we were really looking for were just guys who had a little something that demonstrated that they were a notch above the rest. So we were actually sort of hovering around the registration table and trying to see who was registering best. We were jotting down notes about how they were wearing their socks or about what colleges were on their shirts and trying to figure out if they actually went to that college or just had the shirt.
It was at that point in the tryout when Ben and Sam simultaneously noticed a young man named Daniel Baptista.
We're watching these guys run the 60-yard sprint, and the grass is sopping wet. It's a cold morning. People are slipping all over the place, and hardly anybody's even paying attention. But Ben and I are jotting down every time, and we're making sure our stopwatches are coordinated.
I think this was really the first example of an information advantage.
So this one guy lines up 60 yards away from us, and he's one of the biggest guys there. We make some comment about how this could be, you know, in contention for the slowest time. And then he starts moving, and we just see him really picking up momentum as he goes. And he caught up and passed the much more athletic-looking player that he was paired with. And so Ben and I sort of looked at each other and raised our eyebrows. And I don't think that we said anything because we didn't want anybody to be thinking that we had seen anything significant. But we had kind of been lucky. We had seen this guy who had suddenly been revealed to be a really good athlete. He was about to hit, and we knew one thing about this kid, and that is that he was going to hit. He had the body of a hitter. We were going to be absolutely floored if he wasn't going to put on a show in batting practice. And we knew that once that happened, we would lose our information edge, and whoever was drafting ahead of us would probably pick him. I went over to him and asked him, so why are you here? Why are you at this low-grade tryout? How come you're not playing on a professional team already? And he said, well, you know, to be honest, 9 months ago I weighed 325 pounds, which is just not a weight that you can carry in baseball. He'd been a very good junior college hitter, and then he had gone to a low-level independent league, even lower than ours, and he had played, I think, 6 games, and he had hit the ball very well, but he also tore his ACL, I believe, around the 6th or 7th game, and that ended his season, and that seemed to end his career. He realized that if he didn't lose a lot of weight, he was never going to play baseball again. And so then we asked the next question, which was, would you like to sign with us? And he was a little confused because he knew that the rules were that there was a draft at the end of this tryout. You were going to play all day and hope that a team picked you. And here this team was that was basically saying, we'll sign you right now. Let's sneak you out of this field before everybody else sees you. And so that's what we did. We shook on it. We told him he was on our team. Now we had to sneak him off the field. He was going to go one way, I was going to go the other way, and we were going to meet in the parking lot. One of the rival managers in the league and the chief rival of the Sonoma Stompers managers saw him walking off the field and hustled over to say, hey, what's going on? And we couldn't hear that conversation. We were hoping that he wasn't going to spill the beans, as it were. And sure enough, the manager kind of looks over at us at one point, and we pretend not to be paying any attention. After about 5 minutes, Daniel was able to free himself and came around the corner and met me in that parking lot.
It had to be Sam who took him because I'm a lifelong Manhattanite and never got a driver's license. So Sam made the bold move to ask him to leave and then to drive him away, leaving me at the tryout, quaking in my corduroys on the sidelines.
So we drove to his house, which was about a half hour away. And then we were just waiting for my phone to ring, and about 15 minutes out of town, it finally did. I pleaded ignorance of the rules. I said, oh, it's my first year. Boy, what a mess I've made of things. Baptista would be eligible for the draft, but what we had managed to do is keep anybody from seeing him hit. So when the draft came, we were convinced that either somebody was going to draft him out of spite, just basically because they didn't want us to get away with this, or else they wouldn't draft him because they couldn't take a leap of faith on a guy that they really hadn't seen play baseball at all.
Happily for Ben, Sam, and the Stompers, nobody took that leap.
He set the franchise record for the longest hitting streak. And by the end of the season, Baptista was our best hitter. He's back this year with the Stompers, and the word that I've been hearing from spring training is that he's actually added loft to his swing, and they're very bullish right now, thinking that he could be maybe the MVP front runner.
I think it was at least the first proof that just paying attention in a way that the rest of the league wasn't actually gave us an opportunity or an advantage to exploit.
He is, I think, very grateful that we ended up being the team that signed him. He'd been trying to get a job anywhere, and to have a team go out of its way to tell him that they thought he was really good, I think meant a lot to him.
The tale of the acquisition of Daniel Baptista by the Sonoma Stompers and lots of other stories can be found in the book Ben Lindbergh and Sam Miller have written together. It's The Only Rule Is It Has to Work, and it's subtitled Our Wild Experiment Building a New Kind of Baseball Team. Coming up on Only a Game, the week's news with Charlie Pierce. But will he say? Maybe not. And remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR. Check out Only a Game next week. Hall of Fame pitcher Jim Palmer will tell the story of the first time he faced Hall of Fame hitter Mickey Mantle. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, an intrepid cyclist pedals through disease and past catastrophe. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hello, William.
We have our 2016 Stanley Cup finalists, Charlie. It'll be three-time NHL champion Pittsburgh against San Jose, which has never, ever been to the finals before. Do you find this matchup pitting overachiever against underachiever a compelling one?
First of all, Bill, throw out the record books when these traditional rivals meet. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a hockey lover's dream, I'm sure, from Yellowknife to... From Yellowknife to Hamilton to Saskatoon, people will be tuning in to watch the teams from Pittsburgh and San Jose.
To me, it seems like an unfair fight. I mean, you got Penguins and Sharks. It's just
well, that's true. But then again, the Penguins are the ones who have actually built a hockey tradition.
Excellent
and
point.
San Jose has to convince me that they're not all like automatons built in Silicon Valley. It'll be a good series. The Sharks are playing very, very well right now.
NBA Commissioner Adam Silver said this week that although, quote, human error is part of the game, his words, the referees in his league get the calls right 90% of the time. Now, 90%, was that a celebration of the competence of the referees or a call for better officiating? I'm not sure.
I mean, it's a very tough call. Now, I mean, you know, the moment he said that, 30 NBA coaches fell out of their chairs because it's almost impossible to get anything 90% right. Especially when you're dealing with this size people moving this quickly.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is, of course, there have been some critical fouls at critical times, which you cannot invent a metric for. So if the 10% of the calls that you're getting wrong, if half of those are deciding games, then your referees aren't doing their jobs.
And more to the point, if some number of them happen while everybody's watching.
Right.
Not just
exactly.
Deciding games, but deciding games that people really actually care about at the end of the season.
And not that we would be including gambling in that particular subset of people.
Never crossed my mind to think about it at all. There are some job openings at Baylor University. Football coach Art Briles was fired this week, as was university president Ken Starr. Actually, he was sort of moved around somewhere in the pecking order. Starr fell first, as a matter of fact, but they're both out of jobs for the same set of reasons, right?
Yes, because they covered up for rapists among their athletes. And, of course, this is toweringly ironic in the case of Ken Starr,
who spent
many years chasing Bill Clinton's sex life all over the Beltway, and now he gets fired for covering up even worse things as the president of a devoutly fundamentalist religious university in Waco. The irony is just almost too splendid to keep from commenting on. If the crimes weren't so serious, it'd be hilarious.
Does it change anything?
I hope so. This is, after all, a school who had one basketball player kill another and had a coach involved in covering that up, and now we've moved on to covering up for rapists. I guess they're moving down the scale of felonies.
On Tuesday, Buffalo Bills GM Doug Whaley was interviewed on a Buffalo radio station, and he said of football, It's a violent game that I personally don't think humans are supposed to play, which is an odd thing for him to have said, you would think. And very quickly, he backpedaled on Wednesday. But was the damage already done?
Well, I don't know that it's damage. I think he's telling the truth. At this point, American football is a game that the human body was not designed to play in any way. Oddly enough, the conversation was in the context of Sammy Watkins, a very gifted wide receiver of the Bills. He was asked if he was injury prone, when the fact is that any human being who plays American football at that level is injury prone.
Yeah, I would think so. In 2006, ESPN senior writer Darren Revelle put his name on a waiting list for a Green Bay Packers season ticket. This is 10 years ago. This week, he checked to see how close he is to actually getting a season ticket, and he found that he would not get one in his lifetime. I wonder how many franchises can make that claim.
Well, to be fair, the day that Revelle put his name on the list, there were 73,256 people ahead of him.
Mm-hmm.
He has leaped ahead of 13,256 of those people.
Or they've died.
I'm giving a second for everyone to do the math. That means that, yes, there are still 60,000 people ahead of him on the waiting list. And barring a severe outbreak of the plague in Green Bay, Darren Rovell's great-grandchildren have a shot at seeing Brett Favre IV play quarterback in Green Bay.
Every year at this time, Coney Island hosts the Fun City Bowl.
Fun City!
The New York City Fire Department and the New York City Police Department play football against each other, and it's all for charity, so good on both of them. But it may be time to rename the event, I think. I'm not sure if Fun City Bowl still works.
Hey, it was a pretty good game. The police won 29-13, and then after the game, everybody got together for the traditional post-game good fellowship handshake. And a brawl broke out.
Of course it did.
Yeah. And of course, this being 2016, there was cell phones, so we got video of it. This is something that I think the higher upper echelons in the NYPD and the FDNY should get together on, because they beat each other up at a hockey game in 2014.
Yeah, it's not the first time. Pam Edwards likes Super Mario Brothers a lot. In fact, she likes that video game so much that she almost missed out on an important life event on account of it. What was that?
Shane Birkenbein, her boyfriend, is a self-described tech geek. So he rigged the Super Mario game she was playing to have the words, "Will you marry me?" pop up. And she sort of kept playing the game without noticing that.
She was a little absorbed.
She was a little absorbed, yeah.
Okay.
Good luck to the happy couple, but I would recommend like verbal communication
from
now on.
Maybe set aside 10 minutes a day for
that.
And finally, Charlie, given how much I like soccer, I have sometimes been asked if there's any such thing as too much soccer. And I finally am able to answer that question. Yes, I think there is, and I think the evidence is in Chile. What do you think?
First of all, let's not have anybody say ever that the problem with soccer is there's not enough scoring. One team beat the other 505-504. Of course, it took them 120 hours to do that. And it also took them 2,357 players.
Yeah, they're coming in and out.
You have to believe that there was a rule in place for a golden goal or for some kind of sudden death overtime. Because there's no way 2,300 players will play for 120 hours and be satisfied with a tie.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated. And he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
This weekend, Jenny Finch, who starred for years as a pitcher on the U.S. softball team and won two Olympic medals, will manage the Bridgeport Bluefish, all of whom are men. Pete Rose, still banned from organized baseball, managed the same minor league baseball team in Connecticut a couple of years ago. I saw him do it. Roger Clemens, presumably less pumped than when he was still pitching, will fill out their lineup card for one game in August, or at least he'll carry the card to home plate. But what if the Bluefish or some other ball club were to turn the manager's office over to a woman for real? It's not such a preposterous notion. Women play not only softball but baseball, and women are certainly as likely as men to operate competently in the ever-growing and ever more mystifying world of sports analytics, a preoccupation in many MLB front offices. Nor should this discussion be limited to baseball. This week, the idea that there should be women managing all sorts of men's teams at all levels, including the highest, seems especially attractive to me. That's because one of the nation's most accomplished college football programs has been in the news for all the wrong reasons, namely because the alleged former leadership at Baylor University ignored and covered up numerous instances of criminal assault against women by its football players. As a result of the publicity generated by these practices, Coach Art Briles lost his job, as did university president Ken Starr. Appointing a female as head football coach might not instantly create a college squad that was highly evolved in terms of respect for women and women's rights, not to mention state and federal laws against rape and assault, but probably, at least eventually, football players led by a woman would develop the same loyalty to her that Baylor players expressed in their tweets for their male coach after he was fired. That loyalty and respect might very well translate into healthier attitudes and better behavior toward women in general. Women play all sorts of college and pro sports. They coach some of them with great success. They also serve in the Senate. They serve in the Army and the Navy. They manage large corporations. Why not give lots of them the opportunity to manage teams of men playing football? The ones who turned out to be best at their jobs might go some distance towards changing the culture exemplified by the Baylor stories that we've been reading this week.
I think it's easy to say that a bad day on the bike is better than a good day most everywhere else.
Lou Alexander lives in North Richland Hills, Texas, and he works for a company that builds flight simulators for the military. These days, Lou Alexander spends as many days as he can on a bike. His goal is to ride 100 miles every week, but it hasn't always been that way. In July of 2008, Alexander was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, which began his long and somewhat interrupted journey toward better health. He tells us his story in his own words.
It seems so long ago now, but I don't really ever remember not wanting to take control. It's always been, you know, I'm going to do what I can do and, you know, make the best of the hand that's been dealt. Both my mother and father are diabetic. My older brother is. And I wasn't really surprised at the diagnosis. I was surprised, however, to be diagnosed in my mid-40s. My diet wasn't extremely bad. I wasn't morbidly obese. All of the stereotypes that type 2 diabetics have, I didn't really have. While I knew genetically I was probably predisposed to the disease, didn't think that it would creep up on me that quickly. The way the doctor explained it to me was he was going to prescribe this medicine and that, you know, he could continue to prescribe medicine. I could live my lifestyle the way I had been and would possibly be faced with some complications of diabetes, loss of limbs, you know, the loss of nerves, the loss of eyesight. There's so many very serious things that can happen. But then he flipped his clipboard over and kind of drew this graph and said, the other route you can take is to take control of the disease yourself, make some lifestyle changes, eat better, get exercise, and those two things alone can go a long way to managing the effects of the disease. So the next day I was in the gym doing spin class. I thought I was going to die. You know, after the class, I was exhausted, but you know, probably a short while after I recovered from that, I felt pretty good. And really, through the next month, doing two or three spin classes a week, I started feeling better. A few months later, a friend of mine talked me into buying a road bike, and I'm sort of an in-for-a-little-in-for-the-lot kind of guy. Naturally, when I decided this was what I was going to do, I took it on and was pretty serious about it, and I dropped 30 pounds. My A1C became what would be considered pre-diabetic or even better than that. I was really feeling good then. At the time, I was doing a lot of motorcycle racing on a track. And actually back in March of 2010, I decided to commute to work on a motorcycle and was hit by a motorist. I actually have no recall of the actual accident. That's how violent it was. Severely crushed my tib and fib around the ankle. So bad that when they went to repair the tibia, they had put so many screws in my lower ankle that the surgical wound actually just reopened and exposed bone and metal while I was still in the splint. I developed an infection and took 6 months and nine surgeries to get everything sorted back out. So there was a period of time where I actually wasn't certain I was going to keep my leg. I had a good friend of mine that would kick my butt every now and again when I was feeling sorry for myself. On one particular occasion, I just sent him a text that morning saying, I'm just not going to go. And he goes, well, I'm going to be at your doorstep and I'll pick you up, so you better be ready. I was starting to warm up on the bike before the class started, and a guy comes in with a prosthetic leg. That was kind of a wake-up call that, you know, someone's always got it worse than you. I always knew I was going to be doing something to control my diabetes. I was going to figure out a way to not let this disease get the best of me. I would rather take a beating than go to spin class. So I just started, and I could do about 5 miles. It was hard, but it felt great just to get out and do that. You know, eventually I was working it out till I was getting, you know, 10 miles and then 15 miles. And the next thing you know, 30 miles. So I was actually starting to do personal bests and distances. My aerobic conditioning was improving, but most importantly, my strength. In 2012, I, again, being the in for a little, in for a lot kind of person, decided that to announce that I'm fully recovered, I'm going to ride a full century, which is 100 miles. So I started training for that, and I saw on the calendar the Tour de Cure. And it's like, well, this is raising money for diabetes. I can use this as a training ride, but also raise some money for my disease. I'd set my goal at $500. I've got some very generous friends, and by noon that day, I'd raised $1,000. Got pretty excited about it, and I met one guy that was doing the Houston Tour de Cure, and he talked me into signing up for that and driving down and doing that. And then on the drive back, I came up with this crazy idea of riding 1,000 Tour de Cure miles in a season and raising $10,000. After I got approval from the wife, it took me 12 events, but I was able to make that goal. So far, I've ridden in 35 Tour de Cures. I've raised almost $45,000. You know, going through the motorcycle accident, it certainly that could have turned out with a different outcome. And so my whole outlook on life is you can either be a participant and live life or, you know, just sit on the sidelines. And sitting on the sidelines has never been something I was interested in doing.
This July, Lou Alexander will ride in the New England Classic, a 550-mile Tour de Cure that loops through Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Maine, and Vermont and includes more than 26,000 feet of climbing. Our story was produced by Karen Given. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Martin Kessler. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. We had help this week from Alex Schroeder and from Cedric Freeman at WFYI in Indianapolis. Welcome to our new intern, Ian Foster. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word this week comes from antiquated poetry reader Bob Oakes.
Good morning, Bud Berry, with Mary from Gary and Terry from Erin Go Bragh. Bob Roston of Boston, Tom Costin of Austin, his wife, and the mother-in-law.
Right, I didn't mean to suggest that the estimable Mr. Oakes is antiquated. Only the poetry. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game, and thank you for listening.